Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Millie, and I'm an alcoholic. It's good to see so many of you again, and some of you that have not been to the meeting, so I'm sure that you'll be glad you came. I'd love to be able to say something very florid about our speaker, because I've had so many thoughts and words inside. But rather than have half of his commentary about what I said or didn't say, I'm not going to say too much. The topic of this meeting is sponsorship, and I know that he really doesn't need an introduction, because all of you know him and love him, and his name is Clancy.
My name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here this afternoon, glad to be part of the reconstituted desert powwow, the old desert to the apartment around it. It's nice to be back and see a lot of people here who were here many years ago. Glad to see a lot of members of the Alcoholics Anonymous who come from other areas. People come from other areas, and I've really enjoyed it very much. I've enjoyed the meetings, I've enjoyed the people, I've enjoyed seeing everyone. But it's all, again, just a backdrop to why we are here, that it was so easily forgotten that we are here for the purpose that for some of us, a few of us obtaining, many of us solidifying, and many of us maintaining sobriety. And sobriety, there are, of course, several factors. There are a number of ways to, there are a number of techniques and tools we do. We heard very well about the steps last night from Bob, and how we work through the steps, and how the, sometimes our sponsors are mean and make us go back and do it again and again and again until we get it right, which is the mark of love, I think. And there are people who stay sober by themselves, who are alone, loners. Down in Australia a week ago, and I was talking on the phone to some guy in the middle of the outback who asked that I call him, and he said he just gets by on the book and tapes, and when he does come to town, he doesn't like what he sees. So I understand that. But in my opinion, of all the various aspects, of course, you can't compare sponsorship to the steps, because that's apples and oranges. Sponsorship is something entirely different. It talks about implementing the steps. Well, in my opinion, the most important single aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous is sponsorship. Sponsorship and having a sponsor when you're new, sponsorship and being a sponsor when you've been around a while. And I know of nothing that is more helpful and more solidifying. The book seems to think so too. The book says specifically, when all else fails, what do? You meditate, God, no. You think about things, sift things out, not unless you've got a gun near you to put in your mouth. When all else fails, you work with another alcoholic. And that is, and we talk about action. And we wonder why should sponsorship be such a big deal? You know, you look back, I think with Dr. Bob, the first international convention of AA in 1950 in Cleveland, and he was helped to the podium. He was dying of cancer, and he had a few minutes to convey everything he learned in 15 years. He wanted to share it. And he was quite specific about two or three things that he wanted to talk about. And one, of course, was the one we didn't think about a lot. He said, let's keep our program simple. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes that are of interest to the scientists, but have very little to do with our work here, because what we have here is love and service. We all know love is. We all know service is. There's no big mystery. People sometimes try to make AA a mystery. It is not a mystery. People with very complicated heads want to take a simple thing and make it complicated. And most all of us have done it when we got here. Turns out the project here is to stay there long enough so we can get simple enough to use this simple program. This is how it works. And then the second thing he said was that let us never be too busy to stop and give the man behind us a pat on the back, to help the man behind us. He says, because none of us would be here if someone hadn't done it for us. And that certainly is true. And of course, you want to say what other thing, which is as true today as it was in 1950. He said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and let us remember to use it with kindness and tolerance. Because all of us, especially when we're insecure, have a tendency to build ourselves at the expense of someone else through attacks and gossip, which is human, not certainly reduced into an alcoholic. But of all these things, and one other thing too, Bill Wilson really never had a sponsor. Well, he thought he had a sponsor. I went to the International Convention in 1960 in Long Beach. I didn't want to go, but my sponsor told me how to go, because I wasn't doing well, some old clothes and didn't have any front teeth, and I wasn't doing very well. I knew I'd get there and I'd see someone who I'd been with in the advertising industry or somewhere along the line, or someone that I'd put on airs with, and now they'd see me put. I was just a merry-do-well phony. As I've said many times, I got there and a few of us barbs hanging around one entrance, and all the wealthy people and people had all together up there. And some guy came out. They weren't very well organized in those days, and they came out and said, we need a few ushers. And he looked at us and said, who are the ushers? So they brought us in and gave us a blue armband that said usher on it. He said, now find handicapped people and elderly people to help find the seat. All right. I snatched off the first old lady through the door, took her down the middle, put her in the front seat of the aisle, took off my badge, sat next to her, had the best seat in her entire. I have a picture of that session in my office, and I can see my head, and I recognize it. It had hair on it. It may have been the best AA meeting ever held. Not because I was there, but because what happened. Bill Wilson was the chairman. He was the leader. And he introduced his sponsor, who gave the only convention talk he ever gave. Edwards and him never stayed sober long enough to talk at a convention. And he got drunk after that again. And he was very sad. Sounds kind of funny, but it really wasn't funny at all. He could never quite make it. He had stayed sober 7 years by that time. He lived in Texas, and Bill was so proud. He was his sponsor. And he got up and gave a talk, and then, of course, later on he introduced Lois, and she talked, and he introduced Sister Ignatia, and she talked, and he introduced Sam Shoemaker. Just like, if you've been around anything about AA, and I've been slipping for years, so I heard all these names. It was just fantastic. I tell you, I left that meeting with a man named Eddie Regan, and we were on such a surge that it changed my life for about 5 days. Pretty soon I was back to myself again. But I thought about that. God, Bill Wilson had a sponsor. Everybody has a sponsor. The only guy I ever heard that I know of personally, any long-term AA didn't have a sponsor, and it just used to make me crazy, was you-know-who. Chuck Chamberlain. And he'd get up and he'd say again and again, and he was my sponsor on good days. I think someone told me once upon a time I was the only person who ever acknowledged sponsoring, and he wasn't happy about that. But he meant to be just an example. But anyway, he'd get up and say, I never had a sponsor. I've been and it's kind of hard. You're sitting there, someone that you're sponsoring, trying to get them to do something, and Well, why should I do that? He doesn't have a sponsor. And the answer to that is, shut up. But I've started with Chuck a lot of times. It finally struck me why he doesn't have a sponsor. I finally realized that, and I believe it to be true, and I've believed it to be true for 25 years now. Because he's one of those few people, I've only known two or three in my whole life, who came to AA totally surrendered. He came to AA totally surrendered without any expectancy of anything happening, as he often said, and I believe him. I certainly sat and talked to him a lot of months, and I mean a lot of hours in his house and in the car and going places and coming back. And he came to AA totally surrendered. But I would say that 99 and 9/10 of us don't come here totally surrendered. And we have to be surrendered a little bit, and we have to be guided a little bit. Now, I know there are people who respond to different forms of guidance. There are people who swear by that there's someone's love has enabled them to change. And it must be true because people say it's true. There are people, apparently, who hear something along the way that changes their entire life. I mean, I'm sure if you've been around any while, you've heard of this. They say things like, I couldn't find any comfort. And I went to a meeting one day and I heard this man say, "Let me there." And it all fell into place. And since then, it's just been wonderful. And I've sat and gnashed my teeth. Why didn't I ever hear somebody say something like that? You know, instead of going back to the Big Springs Nut House for more shock treatments. It would be nice, I think that's, you know, I worked out on Skid Row, and I see dying men and women, and it would be nice if they, and dialing up, and people have the effort to refer long-term suffering. You better go see that Clancy, you know. In other words, they're saying, I'm tired of taking time with you. Go see that Clancy. And wouldn't it be nice to be able to have a sentence to say? You say you're having a great deal of difficulty and problem. Just remember this. Never mind if the horse is blind. Keep loading the wagon.
That's it. That's it. Oh.
But I don't know anything. See these poor old Skid Row ladies coming in, trying to get a couple of dollars so they can get a crack, some crack. You won't need that anymore, ma'am. Wet birds don't fly at night. Oh, thank you. I'm going to become a homemaker. But I know of no sentences like that. For me, it's a very long, difficult process, and it is for many people. I think that probably one of the great importances in my life of having a sponsor is that I think, like many people, perhaps not like all people, I did not know what to do. They could tell me, and they could show me, and they could tell, and I could read it. But it was very difficult when you live with a life of inadequacy and fear and despair that you covered up with defiance. And it's an amazing thing. One of the hardest things for people like me to do is to surrender, because I have so little going for me. People with a lot going for them seem to be able to surrender, because then their manhood or their persona is not challenged. But when you have very little going for you, you have to keep it in place. You know, it's like humility. People always say, we have new people, and we have to knock down their arrogance and make them humble. No, you don't have to knock down their arrogance. What you have to do is find a way to build up their self-confidence so they can take down the arrogance which they use to cover their feelings of inadequacy and fear, to build up to humility. And I think in a sense you have to kind of build up to surrender, because when you've lived your whole life behind a wall, not letting people know how you are, even though you know you probably should, it's just so frightening. But I'm going to open up, they're going to see that I'm nothing. And so it's easier to be cynical, and apparently cynical and defiant and so on. And they say, well, why would that be so necessary anyway? Well, it may not be true of many drinkers, but in the book, as it so specifically says again, again, that book is really good, and Bill, I'm sure, was inspired to write much of it, maybe in all of it, because I've always felt that book was one of the few things I've ever seen, never read, but I have come to believe was truly divinely inspired, because he did not know enough to write it, I tell you. He had been sober 3 years, and he was kind of stumbling along, and he wrote about things that will happen that hadn't happened to him yet. He wrote about the 12 promises. Many of those hadn't happened to him yet, which is not unusual for people with these kind of books to write about promises, you know, because all the self-help books give you promises. But after a while, you get older, you realize it's just all exercise and futility. But these promises that he wrote about came true, and they come true for everyone here who does these things. They don't stay true because we're human beings and we screw up. But they get true. I remember sometimes it's baffled. I remember talking to my family was moved out here after I served several years. And I finally, instead of living in a little apartment, I lived in a house with dogs running through and bills and troubles and cares and screaming and no sleep ever, just in rest and simulating interest in others' illnesses. And then on top of that, finding myself going broke. And I called up Chuck. And I said, "You know, Chuck, we got in the middle of confession, you know, I guess that promise isn't coming true. You know, I said, financial security, a little bit. By gee, I'm losing it." He said, "No, you've got it wrong, son." It's fear of financial insecurity you're living. You can be as financially insecure as you want to be, but don't be afraid. I made a noise like a dial tone right after that. But one of the things he talks about in that book, and he says it every once in a while, and it's so important today because we lose it in the midst of everything. He talks about people, alcoholics of our type. And it just goes by because the alcoholics of our type will do this. But that is the operative force behind Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is the answer to all these various fringe operations that claim to cure alcoholism in 5 days, claim to get people sober, they stay sober. Some cases get people returned to social drinking, which is the big thing now, who hold people sober through atheism. There's an organization in Colorado, Alcoholics and Atheistic Alcoholics or something. I used to be on their mailing list. I guess they're not there anymore because I haven't done anything recently, but they are. I used to feel sorry for them, just think how terrible that must be to go to their meetings and have somebody spill a hot cup of coffee and not be able to say, "Oh God!" You know, just some abnormal force, Jesus! And they got these people who are every few years, they got them again now, returning to social drinking. In 1965, I was working in a television station in Hollywood, Channel 9, and they brought in, I've been sober about 7 years by this time, and I was getting VA better, and I brought in this guy from the Chip Shadell Institute in Seattle, and they had a new program where through the application of enzymes, missing enzymes in the body, they could take alcoholics and return them to social drinking. And I thought, Jesus, just my luck. I just missed that, baby. And so I went down, stood behind the camera while I interviewed this guy. And he talked about it. He said, yes. Many times people thought, I've known alcoholics, been in jail many times. But it's now understandable. We now understand that there's a physiological reason for alcoholism. And he said, I can do something that I defy alcoholics to do without enzyme imbalancing. He picked up a martini and drank it. And I didn't even want it, but my tongue went. So I like the taste of martinis, not the effect. And I thought, geez, how's he do that? And it cheered me up a great deal about a month and a half after that, and I read that he his enzymes apparently hadn't kicked in. And he was in a lock ward at Chick-fil-A Deli. And since then, Chick-fil-A Deli no longer says you can return to normal living. Now they talk about stopping drinking entirely. They can do it now in 7 days. But it shows you it can be done if you put your mind to it. But these kind of people who do this, I think, are people who, as Bob mentioned last night, people, heavy drinkers with drinking problems. But when the motivation is correct, they can stop drinking. They can stop drinking in their job or their marriage or something that's really important on the line. And there's another crowd of people who seem to stop for a while and can drink and go back to drinking. And we have all been, at one time or another, thought if we might be in that group. But it turns out the core group of people like us are alcoholics of our type. And they are people who share two characteristics. One, drinking is such a good thing, it does so much for them that it can resolve conflict in day-to-day living and almost instantly change the perception of reality. Together with that, with the resolution of conflict, apparently chemically, sobriety, which was not much to begin with, gets less and less tenable because I think a case can really be made that much of the emotional maturing slows down if it doesn't stop when alcohol begins to work for you. And that's why so many people like me, and I presume like you, wind up, you know, grown up bodies, grown up brains, grown up ability to rationalize, grown up all sorts of things at the beck and call of intermittent childish emotions that just undo everything the brain is trying to do every so often. But what happens is when this dependency on alcohol gets to be difficult, this particular alcoholic of our type try to stay sober. And sobriety eventually becomes untenable. What makes alcoholism, as we understand it, so dreadful is it isn't so much that you can't get off drinking, but that sobriety eventually always becomes worse than the memory of drinking. And eventually you gotta drink. And eventually you gotta get sober. And eventually you gotta drink. And eventually you get sober. And that is called alcoholics of our type. And it has nothing to do with how long you drank or how many years you drank. That's one of the ironies of AA. In the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, most of the alcoholics they were getting were people who had drunk for a number of years, then, as they said, crossed an invisible line where alcohol began to be necessary for their existence. As years have gone by, we have more and more people who have never made the basic social adjustment to life. And they crossed the lines as soon as they drank or shortly thereafter. Which is kind of as my first sponsor pointed out to me, he said, you know, nothing in AA ever asks you to go back to anything, because that's all sickness. The only line in the book that talks about going back says, some people return to normal living. And I was referring to those guys in the early days. He said, but guys like you never had the normal living, so just forget it. Just erase that sentence. I was going to say something, but I couldn't think of to say it, but it was true. So, but that's what makes this paradox of AA. You get old fools get at the podium and say things like, I stayed dry, drank for 35 years before I came to this program, and looks accusingly some little snots and in the early 20s, as if to say, how can you be an alcoholic, you little snot? I drank longer than you've been alive. And what he didn't realize, the little snot is looking up thinking, you can't be much of an alcoholic if you lasted 35 years, you son of a bitch. Because it turns out it isn't how long you drank, it's when it begins to do that for you, when it becomes to be a necessity. And so people come here broken on this rack of they can't stay sober and they can't keep drinking. And they come to AA And so it really is a miracle that people stay sober here, because people like us have been exposed to loving, kind, good help. We used to say for 4,000 years, but now it's longer. And in the paper the other day, they talked about finding some wine 5,000 years before Christ. So that's 7,000 years we've been out there trying. No wonder we're tired of Christ. Yeah. But as long as there's been alcohol, apparently there have been people who react differently to it, who get this unusual reaction. Don't make the unusual reaction. What makes it so difficult to accept you if you just come to you and say, yes, I'm getting a terrible reaction to alcohol, I can't stay sober, help me. But it isn't that way, because nobody ever knows they're getting an unnatural reaction. You have nothing to compare it against. That's just a reaction you get from alcohol. If we sat down and had a dish of strawberries, I could not judge at all. But the reaction I'm getting from them is different than the one you're getting. Because I have no comparative. All I know is I drank and other people drink, and I'm in some kind of trouble. But it isn't really the drinking, it's all these other things. And so when you tell me you're going to get me better by praying, you know, when you, at wit's end, those 12 steps are enough to gag a maggot. It's just idiots here. Well, you're going to ditch your trouble and drunk, and you're crazy, and you're going to turn it all over to God, and you're going to make it all right, and you're going to write down all the secrets you ever told anybody, you're going to read to some blabber mouth, you're going to ask God, and you're going to write a new text of character, and you're make amends to those dirty bastards who've been screwing you for 20 years, and my inventory, and you can sit in your room and think of how. And you can carry this message to others. I think the Spanish language has a colorful word that deals with that. It is adios. It's all very nice, Jim, but it doesn't help me. And then we get down to the root of sponsorship. That's what sponsors are for. To take people who can't accept these things, and little by little, in many cases, have them take actions that seem to have no application in what these things are talking about, that bring about a change. Probably the hardest thing in sponsorship, at least for many people, is to really believe that the sponsor knows the intricacy of my life. Something Bob said last night again, he said he heard several inventories, and there's nothing new in them. I said, that's true. I know I took my inventory of my sponsor finally. I would bet that he's going to make me get his car in Oxnard and hitchhike back and maybe clean off the seat with some antiseptic. But I've taken that trip over 200 times since then with some other boob over there with a flashlight. And let me explain this part first. There's nothing ever new in an inventory. You wish there would be after a while. Just maybe some from another planet, just some new way to do it. There's only so much you really reminded me about. The point is, how do you get to that point, to have the belief you can trust somebody? And that's the hardest thing in the world. And I think one of the great things that helped me in my early sobriety after slipping many years, and I had sponsors. I had some good sponsors over the years, and they were baffled by me, and I was baffled by them, because I treated my sponsors like I treated my psychiatrist. I told them what I thought they needed to know. I didn't want to tell them things that make me look bad, you know. People say, why don't you tell your psychiatrist? A lot of things I wouldn't tell my psychiatrist. If you're paying that kind of money, you can't afford to risk rejection. I'll tell you that. Tell them what he needs to know. One of the great things that happened was I stumbled into a place, and without being choosing to do it, I found myself amongst a group of winners or triers. They always say stick with the winners. And the question is, who are the winners? The people who have been sober the longest? Nah. There are old timers in AA, I wouldn't hire them mow my lawn today. Because I just don't feel they got the stick to it of this to do it. I just don't think they got it. The winners are the people, in my opinion, who are currently trying. And the value of being amongst people who are currently trying is that when you haven't got much going for you, you instinctively blend into what they're doing without intending to do it. It's just that's what they do. I was talking about this the other night. You know, come on, we're all going to a meeting. Mm-hmm. come on, we're going to help Ted move. Come on, Jimmy's at the same gym in a year or so, but let's go over there and sit in the restroom.
Sit in the restroom?
And little by little, you take actions that enable you to stay sober. Painfully sober, it's a room, but sober. And then what happened to me is that someone said to me, you have to get a sponsor. And I had sponsors. But I thought just, who will get a sponsor? I need someone, hopefully, who will get me some front teeth and give me a ticket out of here. Yeah. I tried to do my sponsor. When I lived in Dallas, I got a pediatric doctor as my sponsor because the kids needed help, that's all. But I never talked to him except I told him I told him their symptoms sometimes. But I've had sponsors. The editor of the El Paso paper is my sponsor when I needed to do some work there. I mean, sponsor people. I saw this guy come in and he'd seen him in the movies. He's an actor and he played character actor roles and all the kind you see in the background. You never know their name in the old stock companies, but they're always loving guy. And that's going to be my sponsor. His name is Bob B. And he said he would. And it turned out, as I've said many times, he should have won the Academy Award for every loving role he ever played, because he was a cruel, right-wing, fascist AA pig. In fact, about 2 years ago, I was going down to Oceanside or someplace to talk on Sunday night, and I had one of the FM stations on, and there was an old radio program called Johnny Dollar. I didn't know what I was listening to. And I heard his voice because he played Johnny Dollar and those things. Oh, yeah, I'm here. You're dead. Go back in the grave. I thought he had me for a minute. He said, line up against the wall. Okay, Bob, let me stop the car, folks. What he insisted I do. He didn't care how I felt about this. He insisted I take certain actions. Now, I've quoted him all over the world as saying, I'm here, blah, blah. And actually, someone told me a few weeks ago, he never talked like that, ever. Ever, ever. That's how I heard him, I guess. But he insisted I take actions. And he said, that's the only way people like you would stay sober. And he, little by little, he would have me do things that I... And at first they were just, I suppose in a way, I've said this a lot of times, I don't know why would I put up with it? Because why would you take crap from someone? You don't have to. They talk about, they accuse me in my area of being a dictator type sponsor. But it's impossible to be a dictator type sponsor without the absolute approval of the dictatee. Because all you have to say is screw you and it's all over with. There's no more dictatorship. That's one of the reasons that some old timers think there should be AA police. Come in the night and say, did you say screw you to your sponsor? Come with us for a little re-education down at the camp. Why did anybody take it? I, in a way, I suppose, as I've often said, in a way, I begrudgingly respected him for being able to see through my crap. I love people who I used to love and do not people who like me just for being me or what I'm pretending to do at that time, right? But I never respected them, because I can fool them, they're dumb. Nice, but they're dumb. I didn't like people who could see through me, but I begrudgingly respected them, because they wouldn't put up with my crap. And he evinced some love and some affection to me, but he didn't put up with my crap. And surrounded this club, and I always had nothing going for me. And he got me to do things that I can't conceive myself doing a couple of years before that, unless I were that desperate, you know. God apologize, I didn't. Why should I? I've been told that you called her a bitch. Maybe the sponsor has got snitches and other meetings. She is a bitch. nobody cares what you think. Apologize. If you've got anything going for you, you say, no, I'm not going to. I don't feel I should. But when you're desperate, you say, sorry. You bitch. I'm going to go to that job. Terrible job. Nobody cares. Go to the... Oh, should go to that Tuesday night Central Hollywood meeting. Yeah, see, Miss Bob. So weird meeting. Some of the men dress like women. Some of the women dress like men. There's a guy in an Arab costume with a turban. Better little person goes to that man. You're going to sleep. You suck blood out of your neck. So weird, Miss Bob.
You fit right in.
Now, there's a steady diet, actually. I stayed out of sight as long as I could. But he had me take actions little by little. As I look back, those actions are what saved my life. The desperation that makes you take actions. You say, well, it's true. That's your study. You came off Skid Row, your teeth kicked out, and there's nothing going. They're living in an abandoned car. Sure, it's easy to have a sponsor. But that isn't what sponsorship is about. My sponsorship, in a sense, works less that way than most ways. Over the years, I've had an opportunity to sponsor a lot of people, interesting people. The guy put the flag on the moon, and movie stars, and priests, and psychiatrists, and punchy ex-football players, all sorts of ex-musical legends. And I'm the only one of all those group. I'm the only one who came off Skid Row with my teeth kicked out. They didn't come off Skid Row. They came from homes, and comfortable homes and families. What do we have in common? We had no way to exist in the world without having a drink. And what the thing about AA is that little by little, as you take actions, what happens, you're very slow. It's almost like recruit training. That little by little, you become prepared to take actions that are more meaningful. Actions keep you sober, I believe that. But the steps, of course, I would do it. And I say, well, what's so hard about the steps? Well, the steps don't seem to be able to do much. They're all very nice, but pretty abstract, like the Ten Commandments. All very nice if you're a good person, but no use to the sinner and the bad person. Now, it seems to me that what makes AA such a remarkable thing, and such a miracle, and it's, we take it for granted, is what the purpose of the 12 steps, as far as I can see, in my opinion. You know, Dr. Jung, when he talked to Roland in 1932, said to him, Roland, I misjudged your case. I thought you had a deep psychiatric problem. I see now that you are what is known as an alcoholic, and there's no, to the best of my knowledge, there's no treatment for your condition in the world today at any cost. And which it tells you more than you want to know about your disease, they'll tell you. And he says, what shall I do? He said, well, you have a choice. You can either keep yourself confined voluntarily or involuntarily as long as you live, or else you must surely drink until you go mad or die. He says, is there no alternative, doctor? The doctor said, I've seen a few cases in the literature of people who have deep-seated involuntary psychiatric reversions, which they describe as some sort of a spiritual experience, is a potential rare as to be almost unfound. So Roland came back and he was terrified, of course, with the Oxford movement and stayed sober for a while because I think he surrendered on that ship to his hopelessness and ran across this Eddie and Vermont and got him out of jail and brought him to New York, and he just stayed sober for a while and called him this miserable Wilson who stayed sober. And so here we are tonight, this afternoon. But one of the interesting things, after the book, after Bill Wilson wrote the 12 Steps in 1938, and it came out in 1939, he got some communications from people around the country. He said, there's a mistake in the 12 steps, Bill. He said, what could it be? He said, in the 12th step, and you see this in the first edition of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to carry this message to alcoholics to suffer. He said, we haven't had a spiritual experience. You never have had a spiritual experience. And you know it as a result of these steps. You had it in town's hospital coming off a drunk. How do you spell that? They could not find an explanation for that, because they didn't believe what Dr. Yin said was true. Especially the book sells so slowly, we had a lot of time to think about it before they... But I think eventually, after much searching and talking with each other and talking amongst themselves and talking to people, they started to get a glimmer of something that, when you think about it, we hold true today, certainly as a bulwark of Alcoholics Anonymous, but they didn't know it at the time. And that is this. Alcoholics Anonymous, in some way, it cannot really be scientifically measured. His 12 steps do something, apparently, that nothing was ever done in history of mankind in the treatment of alcoholism. It brings about an incremental spiritual experience. Not the way Bill Wilson got his, but the way we get ours. Make amends to that bitch. And on and on and on. And one day we stand, and I think that's why the next printing of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, they changed the 12th step. The only thing that's ever been changed in the 12 steps. And it reads now, as it always has read since then, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. So the number one function of a sponsor, seems to me, is to get people to take actions they do not yet believe in, to be a source of, to make that person believe they care in what they're doing and accept them for what they are. I suppose the greatest time that comes is when they've written, thinking about that the other night, it's just the fifth step, Thursday night. And it's like when the fifth step, they look at you almost as if you still like me. They don't say it, but they look at you. And they really have a great chance that it's okay. Nothing unending, nothing straight. I'm so glad, you know. But little by little, the great purpose of having a sponsor is having someone to turn to. See, it's a good book written about the history of AA called Not God. And that's, we talk about the early days of AA. That was the great concept, to try to get the alcoholics to realize, I am not God, there are powers higher than I, and to come to believe in them. And they say, well, you come to believe in God. But people such as me couldn't do that, because I was raised believing in God, and I so violated God. In my opinion, if God did grant survival and unvested merit, there's no chance of me even staying sober at all. And you say, well, we all come here and stay sober. Then a lot of people go, and how do you stay sober? And others say, through the grace of God. Which means apparently that God says, you can stay sober, you two can't, you can, this table can't. If that's the way it is, because God's grace falls on anybody, apparently. And if just once God's grace falls on some people, who can stay sober. And how can you believe in that? And especially a person like me, who remember saying when I was first new to somebody, I said, there's no hope for me. I've broken all 10 commandments. And it wasn't for several years after that that I realized I hadn't broken all 10 commandments. I've never coveted my neighbor's manservant. But I've done so many terrible things that I can't accept God. And so I could not accept God. And like a number of people today, I'm so glad I accepted my sponsor as my higher power. For a number of reasons, I kind of respect them and couldn't send me to hell. And people say, what if that crazy bastard got his sponsors as higher power? I'll tell you this today, to say this every time to talk about it. I would rather see someone believe in their sponsor that they believe in than to pretend to believe in a higher power, in a God you don't believe in. Because you can always fool them at 8 o'clock at night, but you can't fool that dark at 2 in the morning. You may come at you then, but you better have something you got to turn to. But my sponsor became a higher power, I didn't know it, and I allowed him to intimidate me. People ask him, my sponsor intimidates you. That's what I think a lot of that's really mean. That's something I give him. He has no power to intimidate me, something I give him. And I always want that, you know, my first sponsor intimidated me, and Chuck Trimble, I never once talked to him. I called him every week for 25 years. And every once in a while, I say, this is Clancy. Just in the few years, he did not know who I was. intimidated. I don't hear our son. That's something to give some. Because I wouldn't want my chum to be my sponsor. Because chums are, that's like people who don't like you anyway, so it's a sense. I want to save my life so that I had sponsors who I felt I had to act differently to get them to like me. Which sounds terrible, but it's really, I didn't think of it that way at the time, but if I can see it that way, I did things to make them like me. The things I did to make them like me, I think it would save my life. Although I would have done to save my life, I would have spent no better. But I know of no greater help than sponsorship, because sponsors translate abstract information into specific actions. Now, I know that some sponsors don't operate that way, and they have very big effectiveness. They say, my sponsor loved me back to health. And I have no objection to that. I have never questioned that. I know there are different paths of, I hate to quote the Bible, but in my father's house or many mansions, I have different ways to do things. But I know for people like me, people who lived in pain and fled in agony and could not accept much, sponsorship had to be reduced to bare essentials. I want you to do this, I want you to be here. Some of the great lessons I learned in life, I learned the greatest spiritual lessons I've learned in life, I learned from my first sponsor. Do you know that? Not prayer. I mean, I knew about prayer, I knew about meditation, I didn't like it, but I knew that. He taught me great spiritual lessons like, do what you said you would do. Be where you said you would be when you said you would be there, or let them know you're not going to be there. Don't take out your hostility on people who can't answer back. Children, employees, waiters, waitresses, a whole list of things. But little by little I try to put them in fact. I can't even do it perfectly now. But I tell you, it changed my life, because the actions of AA, little by little, are really a technique to not to change much about life, except to reduce the conflict of sobriety until it becomes bearable, and one day, with some degree of bitterness, which is preferable to drinking. But I know this, that with all the good things that happened to me, there were times in my early sobriety I almost drank. A couple of times, I remember I was so close, I was walking to get a drink. And one of the things that kept me sober then, sounded very crappy, but I'd use it today if I had to. It suddenly struck me, Bob and a few other guys, John Sullivan and a few other guys, they're all, the ones who liked me would be told, see, I told you so, he never was any good. And the bunch that hated me would say, I told you so, he was a bad guy. I thought, I did not give those dirty bastards the pleasure of being there. And I turned around and walked back just to save my sponsor here. And I was not much of a reason. But I know this, I came to the conclusion finally, I would commit suicide before I would drink. I would not give those people the privilege to attack the people who've been kind to me. And I tell you a funny thing, after 2 or 3 years, my sponsor started Pacific Palisades meeting, 15 years of it right now, got mad at the Pacific Palisades meeting. And he got mad at his wife. He got mad at a bunch of things. He stopped going to meetings. So I talked to him. I said, Bob, you shouldn't do it. He said, don't tell me how to do AA. My God, I got you somewhere to stop it. And he got active. We were at Cinnamon, helped shut down Cinnamon. He got taken some medication for his nerves, some emotions, I heard later. And he eventually drank. He died drunk. This great man, people say, gee, guys, you're not doing very well anyway. Now your sponsor doing such a bad thing. No. He strengthened me. Can you prove to them one more thing? He said, if you don't do these things, you're going to get drunk. He stopped being that drunk. He put an exclamation point on it. And the next sponsor I got, I wasn't looking for kindness and love very much. I was looking for action. A man who had pulled me along in his swirl. Right? That's why I didn't like Chuck Chamberlain. I thought he was a little too smarmy for my taste, just a little. That's our beloved Chuck. Beloved Chuck, yeah. But he was the most active man I knew. And I've told the story before, but on my 7th birthday, I was the Sunday afternoon speaker, which I'm the afternoon speaker, at the Southern California Convention, Bakersfield. and the chairman was someone I sponsored, and the woman in chapter 5 was someone I sponsored. And then they called on him. Just working and shot and broadcasting at Harvard. I didn't even talk. And I went home. I had my wife and Tommy and Mary with me. And they come across to me with that same friend. Yeah, I'm doing so well, I couldn't believe it. I probably have never been this close to drinking since the day I got sober. I believe a sponsor, because I'm just about to. I went through my head, I couldn't think of anybody big enough for AA to be my sponsor. Bill Wilson had been, but he got on that vitamin B crap. I couldn't use him. About other things. But I'm in trouble. So I got home that night and I called up this Chuck C, because I'm the most active man I know. He said, well, come down and see me tomorrow. I've been on a talk about. Come on, see me tomorrow, son. So I went down there. By this time I was feeling a little better. I wasn't so sure that I'd taken a nice step. But I thought, why not give him a break? So I said, Chuck, I'm sorry, strange to you. I've come down to ask you to be my sponsor. He looked at me with big eyes and said, well, that's strange. I was at the meeting yesterday and heard you speak. And I thought you were coming down to offer to be mine. I wish I were. I thought, this is a bad choice. This guy. Well, he didn't much approve of me, but he took me on. If you can call me sponsor, I may not call you my baby at all. If you can be call me sponsor. He didn't talk that either, but that's what I heard. And over a couple years, I used to talk about, I don't know what they're doing in West LA. It's nothing we do down here. It's not AA, but it's keeping people sober somehow, you know. And I opened up the street on my birthday. And, he got up and, of course, the group I founded, most people I sponsored, and my birthday, so it was a big night. He got up and said, well, I guess I'm just a fill-in between chapter 5 and the real important coronation later, but if you don't mind, I'll say a few words about AA. I took my cape and I teared and I said, oh, Chuck, I swear, I don't seem strange, but everybody treats people the same way. We all have birthdays. It isn't the way it looks. I want you, everyone in this room, people I know, don't know, come to my house after a meeting and have a cup of coffee and a piece of cake. It's special, it's Emily. So here we are. I was about the last one out. And God, I got near my block and there's a lot of people milling around with people. Wow. And it turned out that some newcomers I'd worked with Clint, a guy named Clint, and Byron, and Keith, and some other cuties, thought it would be a cute idea for my birthday to have a big tree light put in my driveway during the meeting, to run back and forth, and the neighbors were all up, Jesus, now I... And I came around the corner, and there's Chamberlain saying, he said, just another birthday, right? It took me 10 years to convince him that I did not order that goddamn light. But I called him every week for 25 years, I said, and I don't suppose I had a question for him 20 times. In fact, by the last few years, it was, I look back, probably talking to him because he was sick and old and... And all the people were quite as attentive to him, and I was glad to be on sitting in the hospital to talk to him. All the people who today claim Chuck is their sponsor, never went near the hospital. Makes me want to puke when I hear him talk about it. But yeah, sponsorship is a great thing. Now, I think most of us can agree I'm a sponsor, but why should you be a sponsor? Why, what's so good about being a sponsor? Well, it's quite the part, as I said, the book's talking about with all those stress you rip another alcoholic. One of the big things about sponsorship, and was mentioned again last night, we mentioned all the speakers, can you? The goal here is to get my mind out of self, to get off of me. And I'll tell you something. When I'm thinking about that sick puke, I'm not thinking about this sick puke. That's all, it's just that easy. And you start off probably, sometimes, you know, you just pretend to be interested. One day, with luck, you may become interested. Well, I mean, I was 10 years sober, I was working somewhere as a public relations man, and I was telling someone, that's, you know, what A has done for me. I used to be able to so locked in, and God, sober, I was just locked in. But through A now, I can walk into people's offices. How are you? How's it going? I think to myself, in 10 more years, I'm going to be interested in your answer. Yeah. I don't care how you do it, you goof. But the great thing about sponsorship really is that it's an extension, becomes a real extension of yourself. And it's so sad, you know, and you think, well, why should I try to sponsor people? It's, probably, they just get drunk and do that all the time. And you have to ask you back to that quote, the great story of all time for sponsorship. Bill Wilson, spiritual experience, rushes out of that hospital, goes to the Oxford group, feels he has a compelling drive to help drunks, and he goes and helps drunks and pulls them off the street corner and brings them to Oxford group meetings, these people, upper middle class here. Mm-hmm. You seem to be vomiting on my shoes, sir. And take him home. And this goes on week after week and month after month, and not one of them ever stayed sober. Not only not staying sober, but some of them ripped things out of Bill's house in the early morning, sell them for wine. After about 6 months, Bill Wilson had a good month. His wife was working this kind of society girl, had been reduced to the depression, and working as a counter girl in the department store. And she was supporting everybody with her work. He couldn't work. It seemed kind of tough, but it was in our family. But he got up one day, and the guy who had brought home the night before had left, taken some stuff out of the picture apparently to sell. And he turned to his wife and he said, Lois, I'm sorry. I won't do this anymore. I realize now that I've made a mistake. I know that some sort of thing happened to me. Maybe I can help people. But I've been trying to help people every day for 6 months, and not one person has stayed sober. And she turned to him, and I tell you, right then, your life and mine hung by the thinnest possible thread. I tell you, not funny, thin, thin thread. She turned to him and said something that changed the course of mankind. This was not this, I'm just telling. I was having lunch with you a few years ago in Hartford. I said, Lois, how did you ever think of that remark? It just changed the course of fate. She said, I know, it didn't seem that important to me. It seemed quite obvious. But she said, and he said, I've tried to help these people, and not one person has stayed sober. And she said, you did. And I said, oh, yeah. That's why every time is I want to hear from it. I see it now. That's right. And so we went back and tried it some more, and finally met this drunken doctor and changed the course of history. But in getting out of self, he stayed sober. When he and Dr. Bob got together in Akron, Ohio, Dr. Bob had been a member of the Oxford group, was a spiritual one, spiritual leader, Stanford, between the trunks. Bill Wilson was talking about, they got together for 2 weeks, they sat in Dr. Bob's home, and they discussed the spiritual insights that will help them stay sober, and they had a spiritual glow, it just became wonderful. And one day Dr. Bob said, go to the American Medical Association Convention in Atlantic City and tell them what we found. You stay with my family and I'll be back in 3 days. 3 days later, the office nurse called Miss Dr. I said, the doctor said, they must have trained, so trained this morning so drunk he couldn't walk, and they called him from the station and went down and got him in the cab, and he's laying on the floor of his office. What do I do? And they were just heartbroken. And they went down and picked him up and brought him home, put him to bed, and he was sick of Andrew's son, and Andrew's son. Wasn't that a good name? And then they were observed, God, it's just so sick. What's very sick? When's the name, Bob? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. He said, I've got to do a surgery today. I've got to do a cancer surgery. And if I'm sick, I can't, my hand shaking, I can't do the surgery. So the sponsor let him rest, his wife let him rest, they took him down and brought him a drink, so his hand would stop shaking long enough to do the surgery. And the moment he put the scalpel down in the drink, because they were at the founding of the AA, June 10th, 1935. But after that they realized spiritual insights wasn't working. They hadn't kept it away sober ever. What had kept them sober was working with others. So they decided, we won't spend a lot of time spiritual insights right now. We'll go find another drunk and talk to him. And that changed the course of AA. And they found this Bill up in the hospital. He was a lawyer from Kentucky who was on the run out of Kentucky, and he'd been grinding by the drinking end. He had a very strong wife, and I heard him talk to the usual, saying, "You know, I was laying in a hospital bed in Akron, Ohio, and my wife said, 'There's two fellas who I'm talking to them, I'm drinking.' Not that all hell. But she was rather insistent about it. So I talked to them two fellas, you know. And they came and talked to me, and they never talked to me about my drinking once. They talked to me about their drinking and how they felt. And I never heard anybody describe me so well. I couldn't believe it. I was so impressed, I stuck with them fellas for a little ever since. And he became number three. And through that chain, right down to the nearest person in this room. Sooner or later, like all of our population goes back to Adam, all of this goes down to this. So you come in sponsorship, and you want to help people in, and sometimes you wonder, what am I doing wrong? What am I doing right? I don't know if there's any way to do it. But you know, it's impossible. You think about the great arguments in society about what causes people to go bad. Is it their genes, or is it their environment? And what makes that all, in my opinion, just either bad marriage is this. You can build a family with six children, and they're all exposed to the same environment, and they all got the same genes. And a couple of them turn out well, and a couple of them go to hell, and there's no way to tell. You sit in an AA meeting, and there are six new colors in a row, and you give them the same information, and give them the same day, they're all the same sponsor. And a couple of them will stay sober, and a couple of them will leave soon, and a couple will stay around a while and then disappear. Who can tell? So what they have to do is convey the message. They worry about narcotics addicts taking over AA meetings. And that's true. They have some meetings that take over. But I'll tell you, I can tell you from experience, we're not against narcotics addicts, but the thing that makes AA work and that gives us a singular ability to help one another is that identification. As Bill and Bill talked to Dr. Bob, and then Bill and Dr. Bob talked to Bill Dean, and as all of us talked to one another, the identification. To this day, as much as I know about other people's problems, when I did, a guy gets up to me and talks to the podium about just strict narcotics, I'm touched and it's all very beautiful, but I have no identification. I don't know what the hell he does that. Anyway, a compulsive overeater or a compulsive gambler. I'm very sorry for him, but it's true. Nothing to do with me. But when a guy talks about that surge of drinking and how tough it is to stay sober, and what a sponsor had to do, and you can get in the right rhythm, and little by little, that's what the identification is what changes it. And that's what sponsors are uniquely able to provide, in addition to the things at the meeting, but you're able to say, I understand. You know, all of our lives, people like you and me have had people come over and say, "Oh, I know how you feel." And you just want to shriek out, "No, you don't know how I feel. God damn it, you don't know how I feel. Put your hands off me. You don't know how I feel." And around here, we take these actions of harm. And one day, someone will freely come over and say, "I know how you feel." And you think, "Oh, for God's sake, he doesn't know how I feel." And that's the first rope across the abyss. And there's more ropes, and one day a little catwalk, and one day of a road, and one day of an eight-lane highway. But all does end up, I understand. And sponsor, that's the gift of God. We've been given an unnatural gift to help others. What's that unnatural gift? Are they wonderful? Not at all. The unnatural gift is we have the gift of identification and saying, "I understand," and enabling people to believe, "I do understand, and you have it too." And they may get drunk. And then nobody will stay sober. Who knows? Maybe they will, maybe they won't. First few people I worked with certainly didn't stay sober. And some of the people I worked with now don't stay sober. Lost them just recently. I've seen that long-term slip, and I thought I had that guy right in my right on the road. And just One day this proved, and I felt bad about it. There are people who do still suffer. I get mixed feelings. This year I've had four people I sponsored died this year. Long-term sobriety. One this week. We are preparing to talk at a memorial meeting. The guy who died 2 weeks ago. But those things happen. And indeed, we don't feel sad about it. It's an odd thing. Certainly should feel sad. No. They lived good lives. They were good years, and they got sick and died. And I'm glad they're dead rather than lay around sick. Like I would my own son. Anybody else. It's a strange phenomenon that comes with time. But what I'd say to sum up is this. I know of nothing more valuable for a new person like me than to have someone lay out the grid work of sobriety, because I cannot, I don't know what's important or isn't. I can rationalize and justify it or die. And I know nothing that has been more effective for me in the last 38 years, 37 and a half years, than trying to help others. Sometimes I can and sometimes I can't. I'm not helping them. I'm trying to convey identification so they can believe what they're hearing in AA. That's really what you're doing. Well, years ago, when I was in marketing, and I did a lot of marketing, and there were five tools to teach someone all about a product. If you ever got someone going, you want to teach them about a product, there are five tools. You set them down, and here are the tools. One, shut up. Well, you don't say that when the corporation, you say, I want you not to say anything for a while so I can talk to you. Because you don't know what the hell you're talking about, so just shut up. With AA, you can say, shut up. Number two, listen. Listen. Now, how can I help them listen? Easy. All of us know how it is to sit there and nod, not hear a word, just shoot down incoming thoughts. Do it at AA meetings. Listen. Remember. Remember what? Well, in AA, remember something somebody said that you could identify with. Maybe they don't remember what the hell they're talking about. But you know, yes, I remember that. That's like me. Remember that. Some technique that I can put in my life. Shut up. Listen. Remember. Then practice it. Do it. Practice the technique you learned. One of the first techniques I learned was not stealing papers out of a paper rack to throw away from. And I had a hard time because I worked on papers. They owed me something. I had nothing to buy a paper. And I remember throwing away paper. And no, I can't take that. Put it back. God damn it, I deserve it. Took me a week before I was able to leave it alone. You just almost killed that. But practice things. Practice, like Bob was saying last night. Practicing acts of kindness around the house. That's good. I want to try that someday. I'm pretty sure you'll hit me. What are you being kind for? Not really. I just said it's a good way to get back to a woman, Polly. Shut up, listen, remember, practice. And then the most important one of all, to master a subject, teach it to someone else. And in teaching it to someone else, you take all the abstract information you've got in your head and run it through your own form of reference and you teach it. I have learned more about myself by working with newcomers than I ever did by examining myself. Because there's nothing between Keith's problem and my head than air. But between my problem and my head is rationalizations and justifications and if onlys, and they don't understand why. And to get out of self, to teach, to... And you get, you don't have to be their sponsor. Sponsorship is your own term. Be of assistance to others. You don't have to be their sponsor. So maybe why should be your sponsor? But I've been helped as much by people I see in meetings who are temporarily lost or afraid or desperate. I think the technique is, I sometimes forget this, I want to remember. Instead of just saying to the meetings, let's have the newcomers, look around, catch your arm, make sure you go over there to break and say hi. Not very many people like me do that. We talk about it, but it's inconvenient. They're not in the little coffee pot. Good luck to you, Slim. All those little things, get out of self. Get out of self. If you've not been given any divine gift whatsoever, it's that we've been in the crucible of agony and pain and apparently irresolvable problems and illness, and now in a state of recovery from that illness. One of the greatest tools we have to maintain our recovery is to carry that message to others. And to not do that for ourselves is to commit a gradual intellectual and emotional suicide. So I think that, you know, this is a nice thing. This weekend I've done here really wonderful. But this is May 8th. This is just a nice convention. AA maybe it's Monday night, sitting in a group, a local group. See if you're going to raise your hand. Ambling on over there. Hi. Show them that you care. Give them the help. You'll be glad you did. Thank you.